Sometimes the slugs dug out of the wood hadn't been a bit more misshapen than this one. The wood was so soft.
The son of a bitch, Dr. Simmons said irrelevantly.
I gave the slug back to him and went down to the lobby. It was pretty well cleared out down there now. The politicos had gone. Two or three newspapermen still hung around, waiting for developments. There weren't any developments that day, or the next day either. The boss seemed to be getting on all right. But the third day, he took a turn for the worse. An infection had started up. It moved pretty fast. I knew from the way Dr. Simmons looked, even if he wouldn't say much, that he was a gone gosling. That evening, shortly after I had arrived at the hospital and had gone up to the waiting room to see how Lucy was making out, I got the message that the boss wanted to see me. He had rallied, they said. He was a sick-looking customer when I saw him. The flesh had fallen away on his face till the skin sacked off the bone the way it does on an old man's face. He looked like Old Man Stark up at Mason City. He was white as chalk. When I first saw the eyes and the white face, they seemed to be filmed and unrecognizing. Then, as I moved toward the bed, they fixed on me and a thin light flickered up in them. His mouth twisted a little in a way which I took to be the feeble shorthand for a grin. I came over close to the bed. "Hello, boss," I said, and hung something on my features which I meant to be taken for a grin. He lifted the forefinger and the next finger of his right hand, which lay prone on the sheet, in an incipient salute, then let them drop. The strength of the muscles which held his mouth twisted gave out, too, and the grin slid off his face, and the weight of flesh sagged back. I stood up close to the bed and looked down at him, and tried to think of something to say, but my brain felt as juiceless as an old sponge left out in the sun a long time. Then he said in something a little better than a whisper,
"I wanted to see you, Jack."
"I wanted to see you too, boss." For a minute he didn't speak, but his eyes looked up at me, with the light still flickering in them. Then he spoke.
"Why did he do it to me?"
"Oh, God damn it!" I burst out very loud. "I don't know." The nurse looked warningly at me.
"I never did anything to him," he said.
"No, you never did." He was silent again, and the flicker went down in his eyes.
Then, "He was all right, the doc."
I nodded. I waited, but it began to seem that he wasn't going to say any more. His eyes were on the ceiling, and I could scarcely tell that he was breathing. Finally, the eyes turned toward me again, very slowly, and I almost thought that I could hear the tiny, painful creak of the balls in their sockets. But the light flickered up again. He said,
"It might have been all different, Jack."
I nodded again. He roused himself more. He even seemed to be straining to lift his head from the pillow.
"You got to believe that," he said hoarsely.
The nurse stepped forward and looked significantly at me. "Yes," I said to the man on the bed.
"You got to," he said again. "You got to believe that."
"All right." He looked at me, and for a moment it was the old, strong, probing, demanding glance. But when the words came this time, they were very weak.
"And it might even have been different yet," he whispered. "If it hadn't happened, it might have been different even yet."
He barely got the last words out. He was so weak. The nurse was making signals to me. I reached down and took the hand on the sheet. It felt like a piece of jelly. "So long, boss," I said. "I'll be seeing you." He didn't answer, and I wasn't even sure that there was recognition in the eyes now. I turned away and went out. He died the next morning, just about day. There was a hell of a big funeral. The city was jam-packed with people, all kinds of people, county courthouse slickers and rednecks and wool hat boys and people who had never been on pavement before. And they had their women with them. They filled all the space around the Capitol and spilled and eddied back into the streets beyond, while the drizzle came down and the loudspeakers placed on the trees and poles blared out the words which made you want to puke. Then after the coffin had been brought down the great steps of the Capitol and loaded into the hearse, and after the state patrolmen and the mounted cops had fought out a passage, the procession rolled slowly away to the cemetery. The crowd seethed after it. At the cemetery they surged and swayed over the grass, trampling the graves, breaking down shrubbery. A couple of gravestones were overturned and broken. It was 2 hours after the burial before the police managed to clear the place. That was my second funeral within a week. The first one had been very different. It had been the funeral of Adam Stanton, down at Burden's Landing. Chapter 10. After the boss was safe underground, and the puzzle-gutted city cops, sweating in their blue, and lean, natty boys of the state patrol, and the mounted police on glossy, dancing horses, whose hoofs sank fetlock deep in the flower beds, had driven the crowd sullenly out of the cemetery, but long before the tramped grass began to lift itself or the caretakers came to repair the knocked-over tombstones, I left town and took out for the landing. There were two reasons. First, I couldn't stand to stay in town. Second, Ann Stanton was at the landing. She had been there since Adam's funeral. She'd gone down with the body, trailing the sun-glittering, expensive hearse in an undertaker's limousine with a nurse who proved to be superfluous, and Katie Maynard, an old friend who proved, no doubt, to be superfluous, too. I didn't see her as she sat in the rented limousine, which moved at its decorous torturer's pace the near 100 miles, lifting the miles slowly off the concrete slab, slowly and fastidiously, as though you were peeling an endless strip of skin off the live flesh. I didn't see her, but I know how she had been. Erect, white in the face, the beautiful bones of her face showing under the taut flesh, her hands clenched in her lap. For that was the way she was when I saw her standing under the moss-garlanded oaks, looking absolutely alone despite the nurse and Katie Maynard and all the people, friends of the family, curiosity-seekers come to gloat and nudge, newspapermen, big-shot doctors from town and from Baltimore and Philadelphia, who stood there while the shovels did their work. And she was that way when she walked out of the place, not leaning on anybody, with the nurse and Katie Maynard trailing along with that look of embarrassed and false piety which people get on their faces when they're caught in the open with the principal mourner at a funeral. Even when, just as she was coming out the gate of the cemetery, a newspaperman jammed a camera at her and took her picture, she didn't change the expression on her face. He was still there when I came up, a squirt with his hat over one eye and the camera hung round his neck and a grin on his squirt face. I thought maybe I'd seen him around town, but maybe not. The squirts look so much alike when they grind them out of journalism school. "Hello," I said. He said hello. "I saw you get that picture," I said. He said, "Yeah." "Well, son," I said, "if you live long enough, you'll find out there are some kinds of a son of a bitch you don't have to be, even to be a newspaperman." He said, "Yeah," out of his squirt face and looked at me. Then he asked, "You a Burden?" I nodded. "Jesus Christ," he exclaimed. "You work for Stark and you call somebody a son of a bitch?" I just looked at him. I'd been over all that ground before. I'd been over it 1,000 times with 1,000 people. Hotel lobbies and dinner tables and club cars and street corners and bedrooms and filling stations. Sometimes they didn't say it just exactly that way, and sometimes they didn't say it at all, but it was there. Oh, I'd fixed them, all right. I knew how to roll with that punch and give it right back in the gut. I ought to have known. I'd had plenty of practice. But you get tired. In a way, it's too easy, and so it isn't fun anymore. And then you get so you don't get mad anymore. It has happened so often. But those aren't the reasons. It's just that those people who say that to you, or don't say it, aren't right and they aren't wrong. If it were absolutely either way, you wouldn't have to think about it. You could just shut your eyes and let them have it in the gut. But the trouble is, they are half right and half wrong. And in the end, that's what paralyzes you, trying to sort out the one from the other. You can't explain it to them, for there isn't ever time, and there's always that look on their faces. So you get to a point in the end where you don't even let them have it in the gut. You just look at them. And it's like a dream or something remembered from a long time back, or like they weren't there at all. So I just looked at the squirt face. There were other people there. They were looking at me. They expected me to say something or do something. But somehow I didn't even mind their eyes on me. I didn't even hate them. I didn't feel anything except a kind of numbness and soreness inside, more numbness than soreness. I stood there and looked at him and waited the way you wait for the pain to start after you've been hit. Then, if the pain started, I'd give it to him. But it didn't start, and there was just the numbness. So I turned around and walked away. I didn't even mind the eyes that were following me or the snatch of a laugh somebody gave and cut off short because it was a funeral. I walked on down the street with the numbness and soreness in me, but what had happened at the gate hadn't given it to me. I had had it before I came. I went on down the road toward the Stanton house. I didn't imagine she'd want to see me right then, but I intended to leave word that I'd be at the hotel down at the landing till late afternoon. This, of course, if something didn't break about the boss's condition. But when I got to the Stanton house, I learned that Ann wasn't seeing anybody. Katie Maynard and the nurse weren't superfluous anymore, for when Ann entered the house, she went into the living room and stood there just inside the door and looked slowly all over the place, at the piano, the furniture, piece by piece, the picture above the fireplace, the way a woman looks over a room just before she sails in to redecorate the place and rearrange the furniture. That was Katie Maynard's way of putting it. And then she just gave down. She didn't even reach for the door jamb or stagger or make a sound, they said. She just gave down, now it was over, and was out cold on the floor. So when I got there, the nurse was upstairs working on her, and Katie Maynard was calling the doctor and taking charge. There wasn't any reason for me to stay. I got in my car and headed back to the city. But now the boss was dead, too, and I was back at the landing. My mother and her Theodore were off on a trip, and I had the house to myself. It was as empty and still as a morgue, but even so it was a bit more cheerful than the hospitals and cemeteries I'd been hanging around. What was dead in this house had been dead a long time, and I was accustomed to the fact. I was even becoming accustomed to the fact of the other deaths. They'd shoveled it over Judge Irwin and Adam Stanton and the boss. But there were some of us left, and Ann Stanton was among those left. And I was. So back at the landing again, we sat on the gallery side by side when there was sun, the lemon-pale sun of late autumn, and the afternoon made its shortened arc over the onyx-mottled waters of the bay, which stretched south to the autumn hazy horizon. Or when there wasn't any sun and the wind piled the sea up over the beach, even to the road, and the sky seemed to be nothing but gusty rain, we sat side by side in the living room. Either place, we never talked much those days, not because there was nothing to say, but because there might be too much, and if you once started, you would upset the beautiful and perilous equilibrium which we had achieved. It was as though we each sat on the end of a seesaw, beautifully balanced, but not in any tidy little play yard, but over God knows what blackness, on a seesaw which God had rigged up for us kiddies. And if either of us should lean toward the other, even a fraction of an inch, the balance would be upset and we would both go sliding off into that blackness. But we fooled God and didn't say a word. We didn't say a word, but some afternoons I read to Anne. I read the first book I'd laid hand to the first afternoon when I found I couldn't sit there any longer in that silence which bulged and creaked with all the unsaid words. It was the first volume of the works of Anthony Trollope. That was a safe bet. Anthony never upset any equilibriums. In a peculiar way, those late autumn days began to remind me of the summer almost 20 years before, when I had fallen in love with Anne. That summer we had been absolutely alone, together, Even when people were around, the only inhabitants of the kind of floating island or magic carpet which being in love is. And now we were absolutely alone, but it was a different kind of floating island or magic carpet. That summer we had seemed to be caught in a massive and bemusing tide which knew its own pace and time and would not be hurried even to the happiness which it surely promised. And now again we seemed to be caught in such a tide and couldn't lift a finger in its enormous drift, for it knew its own pace and time. But what it promised, we didn't know. I didn't even wonder. Now and then, however, I wondered about something else. Sometimes when I was sitting beside her, reading or not talking, and sometimes when I was away, eating breakfast or walking down the row or lying awake, there was a question without an answer. When Anne had told me about Adam's last wild visit to her apartment, how he rushed in and said he wouldn't be pimp for her and all that. She had said that some man had telephoned Adam to tell him about her and Governor Stark.
Who?
In the first days after the event, I'd really forgotten the fact, but then the question came. At first, even then, the question didn't seem important to me, for nothing seemed very important to me then in the pervasive soreness and numbness. Or at least what seemed important to me then had nothing to do with the question. What had happened was important, but not the cause of what had happened, insofar as such a cause was not in me myself. But the question kept coming back. Even when I wasn't thinking of it, I would suddenly be aware of its gnawing, like a mouse's tooth stitching away inside the wainscoting of my mind. For a while I didn't see how I could ask Anne. I couldn't ever say anything to her about what had happened. We would sit forever in our conspiracy of silence, forever bound together in that conspiracy by our awareness of our earlier, unwitting conspiracy to commit Adam Stanton and Willie Stark to each other and to their death. If we should ever break the conspiracy of silence, we might have to face the fact of that other conspiracy and have to look down and see the blood on our hands. So I said nothing. Until the day when I had to say it. I said, "Anne, I'm going to ask you one question about it. Then I'll never say another word about it to you unless you speak up first." She looked at me without answering, but I could see in her eyes the recoil of fear and pain, and then the stubborn mustering of what forces she had. So I plunged on. "You told me, that day when I came to your apartment, that somebody had telephoned Adam, had told him about me, she said, finishing the sentence on which I had for the moment wavered. She hadn't waited for the impact. With whatever force she had, she was meeting it head on. I nodded. "Well," she queried, "did he say who had telephoned him?" She thought a minute. You could see her, even as she sat there, lifting the sheet off that moment when Adam had burst in on her, like somebody lifting the sheet off the face of a corpse on a marble slab in a morgue and peering into the face. Then she shook her head. "No," she said, "he didn't say..." She hesitated. "Except that it was a man. I'm sure he said man." So we resumed our conspiracy of silence, while the seesaw wavered and swayed beneath us, and the black clawed up at us, and we clung on. I left the landing the next day. I got to town in the late afternoon and put in a call to Sadie Burke's apartment. There was no answer. So I tried the Capitol on the off chance that she would be there, but there was no answer on her extension. Off and on during the evening I tried her apartment number, but with no luck. I didn't go around to the Capitol to see her in the morning. I didn't want to see the gang who would be there. I didn't ever want to see them again. So I telephoned again. Her extension didn't answer, so I asked the switchboard to find out, if possible, where she was. After 2 or 3 minutes, the voice said, "She's not here. She's ill. Will that be all, please?" Then, before I could put my thoughts in order, I heard the click of being cut off. I rang again. "This is Jack Burden," I said, "and I'd like to..." "Oh, Mr. Burden," the switchboard said noncommittally, or perhaps in question. There had been a time, and it hadn't been very long back, when the name Jack Burden got something done around that joint. But that voice, The tone of that voice told me that the name Jack Burden didn't mean a damn thing but a waste of breath around there anymore. For a second, I was sore as hell. Then I remembered that things had changed. Things had changed out there. When things change in a place like that, things change fast and all the way down, and the voice at the switchboard gets a new tone when it speaks your name. I remembered how much things had changed. Then I wasn't sore anymore, for I didn't give a damn. But I said sweetly, "I wonder if you can tell me how to get in touch with Miss Burke. I'd sure appreciate it." Then I waited a couple of minutes for her to try to find out. "Miss Burke is at the Millet Sanatorium," the voice then said. Cemeteries and hospitals. I was back in the swing of things, I thought. But the Millet place wasn't like the hospital. It didn't look at all like a hospital, I discovered when I turned off the highway 25 miles out of the city and tooled gently up the drive, under the magnificent groining of the century-old live oaks, whose boughs met above the avenue and dripped stalactites of moss to make a green, aqueous gloom like a cavern. Between the regularly spaced oaks stood pedestals on which classical marbles, draped and undraped, male and female, stained by weathers and leaf acid and encroaching lichen, looking as though they had, in fact, sprouted dully out of the clinging black-green humus below them, stared out at the passer-by with the faintly pained, heavy, incurious unamazement of cattle. The gaze of those marble eyes must have been the first stage in the treatment the neurotic got when he came out to the sanatorium. It must have been like smearing a cool unguent of time on the hot pustule and dry itch of the soul. Then, at the end of the avenue, the neurotic reached the sanatorium, which graciously promised peace beyond the white columns. For the Millet Sanatorium was what is called a rest home. But it had been built more than a century back for vanity and love by a cotton snob to whom money had been no object, who had bought near a shipload of Empire furniture in Paris for his house and near a shipload of shining marble statues in Rome for his avenue, and who had probably had a face like brutally hewed cedar and not a nerve in his body. And now people who were descended from such people, or who had enough money, made in the administration of Grant or Coolidge, to assume that they were descended from such people, brought their twitches, ticks, kinks, and running sores out here, and rested in the high-ceilinged rooms, and ate crawfish bisque, and were soothed by the voice of a psychiatrist in whose wide, unwavering, brown, liquid, depthless eyes one slowly drowned. I almost drowned in those eyes during the one-minute interview I had in order to get permission to see Sadie. "She's very difficult," he said. Sadie was lying on a chaise lounge by a window which gave over a stretch of lawn sloping down to a bayou. Her chopped-off black hair was wild, and her face was chalk-white, and the afternoon light striking across it made it look more than ever like the Plaster of Paris mask of Medusa riddled with BB shot. But it was a mask flung down on a pillow, and the eyes that looked out of it belonged to the mask. They didn't belong to Sadie Burke. There wasn't anything burning there. "Hello, Sadie," I said. "I hope you don't mind me coming to see you." She studied me a moment out of the unburning eyes. "It's okay with me," she said. So I sat down and hitched my chair up closer and lighted a cigarette. "How you getting on?" I asked. She turned her head in my direction and gave me another long look. For an instant there was a flicker in the eyes as when a breath of air touches an ember. "Look here," she said. "I'm getting on all right. Why the hell shouldn't I be getting on all right?" "That's fine," I said. "I didn't come out here 'cause there was anything wrong with me. I came 'cause I was tired. I wanted a rest. That's what I said to that goddamn doctor. I said I'm here to get a rest 'cause I'm tired, and I don't want you messing around and trying to swap secrets with me and find out if I ever had any dreams about red fire engines. I said if I ever get started swapping secrets with you, I'd burn your ears off. But I'm here to rest, and I don't want you in my hair," I said. "I'm tired of a lot of things, and I'm goddamn tired of a lot of people, and that goes for you too, Doc." She pushed herself up on one arm and looked at me, then said,
And that goes for you too, Jack Burden. I didn't say anything to that, and I didn't move. So she sank back down and into herself. I let my cigarette burn up in my fingers and lighted another one before I said, "Sadie, I reckon I know how you feel, and I don't want to be bringing everything up again, but..."
"You don't know a thing about how I feel,"
she said.
"Some idea, maybe," I said.
"But what I came for was to ask you a question."
"I thought you came because you were so damn fond of me."
"As a matter of fact," I said, "I am. We've been around a long time together, and we always got along, but that's not..."
"Yeah,"
she interrupted and again thrust herself up on one arm.
"Everything and everybody just got along fine. Oh, Jesus, just fine."
I waited while she sank back again and turned her eyes from me across the lawn below toward the bayou. A crow was making its way across the clear air above the tattered cypress tops beyond the bayou. Then the crow was gone, and I said, "Adam Stanton killed the boss, but he never got that idea by himself. Somebody primed him to do it. Somebody who knew the kind of man Adam was and knew the inside of how he took the job at the medical center and knew..." She didn't seem to be listening to me. She was watching the clear air above the tattered cypresses where the crow had gone. I hesitated and then, watching her face, went on. "And knew about the boss and Ann Stanton." I waited again and watched her face as I handed those names to her, but it didn't show a thing. It simply looked tired, tired and not giving a damn. "I found out one thing," I continued. "A man called up Adam that afternoon and told him about the boss and his sister. And some more stuff. You can guess what stuff. So he went wild. He went to see his sister and jumped her, and she didn't deny it. She isn't the kind of person who could deny it. I guess she was sick of having a secret, and she was almost glad not to have it any longer, and..."
"Yeah,"
Sadie said, not turning to me.
"Tell me how noble and high-toned Ann Stanton is."
"I'm sorry," I said, and felt the blood flushing my face. I guess I did get off the point.
"I guess you did, all right."
I waited. "Then, that man who called up Adam, do you have any notion who it was?" She seemed to be turning that question over in her mind, if she had heard it, for I couldn't be sure. "Do you?" I asked.
"I don't have any notion,"
she said.
"No?"
"No," she said, still not looking at me.
"And I don't have to have any, because, you see, I know."
"Who?" I demanded.
"Who?"
And came up out of my chair.
"Duffy,"
she said.
"I knew it,"
I exclaimed. "I ought to have known it. It had to be."
"If you knew it," she said, "why the hell you come messing around me for?"
I had to be sure. I had to know. Really know. I stopped and stood there at the foot of the chaise lounge and looked down at her averted face, which the sunlight lay across.
"You say you know it was Duffy. How do you know?" "God damn you, Jack Burden. God damn you,"
she said in a tired voice, and turned her head to look up at me. Then, looking at me, she thrust herself up to a sitting position and burst out in a voice which all at once wasn't tired anymore, but angry and violent.
"God damn you, Jack Burden! What made you come here? What always makes you mess in things? Why can't you leave me alone? Why can't you? Why?"
I stared down into the eyes, which in the pain-contorted face were burning now and wild. "How do you know?" I demanded softly.
"God damn you, Jack Burden! God damn you!"
she said like a litany. "How do you know?" I demanded, more softly than before. I was almost whispering, and leaned down toward her.
"God damn you, Jack Burden!"
she said. "How do you know?"
"Because,"
she began, hesitated, and tossed her head in a desperate, tired way like a fevered child on a pillow. "Because?" I demanded.
"Because,"
she said, and let herself fall back on the cushions of the chaise lounge.
"I told him. I told him to do it.
That was it. That was it, and I hadn't guessed it. My knees gave slowly down, like a pneumatic jack letting down the weight of a car to the floor, and I was back in my chair. There I was, and there Sadie Burke was, and I was looking at her as though I'd never seen her before. After a minute, she said,
"Stop looking at me."
But there wasn't any heat in what she said. I must have continued to look, for she said, as before,
"Stop looking at me."
Then I heard my lips saying, as though to myself,
"You killed him." "All right," she said. "All right, I killed him. He was throwing me over. For good. I knew it was for good that time. For that Lucy. After all I had done. After I made him. I told him I'd fix him. But he turned that new sick smile of his on me like he was practicing to be Jesus and took my hands in his and asked me to understand. Understand, Jesus." And just then, like a flash, I knew I'd kill him.
"You killed Adam Stanton," I said.
"Oh, God," she breathed. "Oh, God."
"You killed Adam," I repeated.
"Oh,"
she breathed.
"And I killed Willie. I killed him."
"Yes," I agreed and nodded.
"Oh, God,"
she said, and lay there staring up at the ceiling. I had found out what I'd come to find out, but I kept on sitting there. I didn't even light a cigarette. After a while, she said,
"Come over here. Pull your chair over here."
I hitched my chair over by the chaise lounge and waited. She didn't look at me, but she reached out her right hand uncertainly in my direction. I took it and held it while she continued to stare at the ceiling, and the afternoon light struck cruelly across her face.
"Jack,"
she said finally, still not looking at me. "Yes?"
"I'm glad I told you,"
she said.
"I knew I had to tell somebody, sometime. I knew it would come, but there wasn't anybody for me to tell, till you came. That's why I hated you for coming. As soon as you came in the door, I knew I'd have to tell you. But I'm glad I told. I don't care who knows now. I may not be noble and high-toned like that Stanton woman, but I'm glad I told."
I didn't find much to say to that. So I continued to sit there for quite a while, holding Sadie's hand in the silence which she seemed to want, and looking across her down toward the bayou, which coiled under the moss depending from the line of tattered cypresses on the farther bank, the algae-mottled water heavy with the hint and odor of swamp, jungle, and darkness along the edge of the expanse of clipped lawn. I had found out that Tiny Duffy, who was now governor of the state, had killed Willie Stark as surely as though his own hand had held the revolver. I had also found out that Sadie Burke had put the weapon into Duffy's hand and had aimed it for him, that she, too, had killed Willie Stark. And Adam Stanton. But what she had been done hot. What Duffy had been done cold. And in the end, Sadie Burke's act had somehow been wiped out. It didn't exist for me anymore. And that left Duffy. Duffy had done it. And strangely, there was a great joy and relief in that knowledge. Duffy had done it, and that made everything clear and bright as in frosty sunshine. There, over yonder, was Tiny Duffy with his diamond ring, and over here was Jack Burden. I felt free and clean, as when you suddenly see that, after being paralyzed by ignorance or indecision, you can act. I felt on the verge of the act. But I didn't know what the act was to be. When I went back out to see Sadie, she had asked me to come back, she told me, without my saying a word on the subject, that she would make a statement if I wanted her to. I told her that that was wonderful, and I felt that it was wonderful, for I still felt clean and free on the verge of the act, and she was putting the thing into my hand. I thanked her.
"Don't thank me," she said. "I'm doing myself a favor. Duffy, Duffy,
She rose to a sitting position on the chaise lounge, and her eyes had the old flash.
You know what he did?
Before I could answer, she plunged on.
Afterwards, after it had happened, I didn't feel a thing, not a thing. I knew that night what had happened, and I didn't feel a thing. And next morning, Duffy came to me. He was grinning and puffing, and he said, Girlie, I'll sure hand it to you. I'll sure hand it to you. I didn't feel a thing, not even when I looked in his face. But then he put his hand around my shoulder and sort of patted and rubbed my back between the shoulder blades and said, Girlie, you sure stopped his clock, and I ain't forgetting you, girlie. You and me, we might sure get along. Then it happened. It happened right then. It was like it had all happened that second, right in front of me instead of up at the Capitol. And I clawed at him and jumped away. I ran out of the place. And 3 days later, after he died, I came here. It was the only place I could come.
Well, thanks anyway, I said. I reckon we can stop Duffy's clock.
It won't stick in law, she said.
I didn't reckon it would. Whatever you said to him or he said to you doesn't prove a thing, but there are other ways. She thought a while.
Then, any other way, law or not, and I reckon you know it drags that...
She hesitated and didn't say what she was about to say, then revised it.
Drags Ann Stanton into it.
She'll do it, I affirmed. I know she would. Sadie shrugged.
You know what you want, she said.
You all. I want to get Duffy.
That suits me,
she said, and again shrugged. Suddenly she seemed to have gone tired again.
That suits me, she repeated.
But the world is full of Duffys. It looks like I've been knowing them all my life. I'm just thinking about one, I declared. I was still thinking about that one about a week later. By this time it seemed that the only way was to break the thing through an anti-administration paper. When I got the note from that particular Duffy himself, would I mind coming to see him, it said, at my convenience. My convenience was immediately, and I found him imperially and porcinely filling his clothes and the great leather couch in the library at the mansion where the boss used to sit. The leather of his shoes creaked as he stepped forward to greet me, but his body swayed with the bloated lightness of a drowned body, stirred loose at last from the bottom mud of the river to rise majestically and swayingly to the surface. We shook hands, and he smiled, and waved me to a seat as the couch groaned to receive him. A black boy in a white coat brought the drinks. I took the drink but declined a cigar and waited. He said how sad it was about the boss. I nodded. He said how the boys all missed the boss. I nodded to that. He said how things were getting done, though, just like the boss would have wanted. I nodded to that. He said how they sure missed the boss, though. I nodded to that. He said, Jack, the boys sure miss you around here, too. I nodded modestly and said that I sure missed the boys. Yeah, he resumed. I was saying to myself the other day, just let me get settled in a harness, and I'm going to get a hold of Jack. Yeah, Jack's the kind of fella I like to have around. The boss sure thought a lot of him, and what was good enough for the boss is good enough for old Tiny. Yeah, I said to myself, I'm going to get old Jack, the kind of guy I need, a square shooter, a guy you can trust. He'll speak the truth, fear nor favor. His word is his bond.
Are you referring to me? I asked.
I sure am, he replied, and I'm making you a proposition. I don't exactly know what arrangement you had with the boss, but you just tell me straight what it was, and I'll up it 10%.
I had no complaints about my treatment.
Now that's talking like a white man, Jack, he said, and added earnestly, and don't get me wrong, I know you and the boss was like that.
He held up two large, white, glistening Episcopal fingers as in benediction.
Like that, he repeated. And don't get me wrong, I'm not criticizing the boss. I just want to show you I appreciate you.
Thanks, I said with some lack of warmth. The lack of warmth was such, I presume, that he leaned slightly forward and said,
Jack, I'm going to make that 20%.
That's not enough, I said.
Jack, he said, you're right. That's not enough. 25%.
I shook my head. He showed a slight uneasiness and the couch creaked, but he rallied with a smile.
Jack, he said soothingly, you just tell me what you think's right, and I'll see how we make out. You tell me what's enough.
There ain't enough, I said.
Huh?
Listen, I said, didn't you just tell me that I'm the guy whose word is his bond?
Yeah, Jack.
So you'll believe me if I tell you something?
Why, yeah, Jack.
Well, I'm telling you something. You're the stinkingest louse God ever let live. I relished the moment of profound silence which followed, then plunged on. And you think you can buy me in? Well, I know why you want to. You don't know how much I know or what. I was thick with the boss, and I know a lot. I'm the joker in the deck. My name is Jack, and I'm the wild Jack, and I'm not one-eyed. You want to deal me to yourself from the bottom of the deck, but it's no sale, Tiny. It's no sale. And it's too damn bad, Tiny, and you know why?
Look here, he said with authority. Look here, you can't be...
It's too bad because I do know something. I know a lot. I know that you killed the boss.
It's a lie,
he exclaimed and heaved on the couch, and the couch creaked. It's no lie and it's no guess, though I ought to have guessed it. Sadie Burke told me. She's
in it. She's in it.
She was in it, I corrected, but not anymore. And she'll tell the world. She doesn't care who knows. She's not afraid.
She better be.
She's not afraid because she's tired. She's tired of everything, and she's tired of you.
I'll kill her,
he said, and the perspiration exuded delicately on his temples. You won't kill anybody, I said, and this time there's nobody to do it for you. For you're afraid to. You were afraid to kill the boss, and you were afraid not to, but luck helped you out. But you gave luck a little push, Tiny, and I swear I admire you for it. It opened my eyes. You see, Tiny, all those years I never thought you were real. You were just something off the cartoon page, with your diamond ring. You were just the punching bag the boss used, and you just grinned your sick grin and took it. You were like the poodle I heard about. You ever hear about the poodle? I didn't give him time to answer. I watched his mouth get ready, then I went on. There was a drunk had a poodle, and he took him everywhere with him, from bar to bar. And you know why? Was it devotion? It was not devotion. He took that poodle everywhere just so he could spit on him and not get the floor dirty. Well, you were the boss's poodle, and you liked it. You liked to be spit on. You weren't human. You weren't real, that's what I thought. But I was wrong, Tiny. Somewhere down in you there was something made you human. You resented being spit on, even for money. I got up with my half-empty glass in my hand. And now, Tiny, I said, that I know you are real, I sort of feel sorry for you. You're a funny old fat man, Tiny, with your heart getting bad and your liver nigh gone and sweat running down your face, and a mean worry on your mind and a great blackness like water rising in a cellar inside you. And I almost feel sorry for you, but if you say a word, I might stop feeling sorry for you. So now I'm going to drink up your whiskey and spit in the glass and go. So I drank off the whiskey, dropped the glass on the floor, on the thick rug it didn't break, and started for the door. I'd almost got there when I heard a croak from the couch. I looked around.
He croaked, it won't stand in a court.
I shook my head. No, I said it won't. But you still got plenty to worry about. I opened the door and walked through and left the door open behind me and walked down the long hall under the great glittering chandelier and walked out into the brisk night. I took a deep drag of fresh air and looked up through the trees at the distinct stars. I felt like a million. I had sure God brought off that scene. I had hit him where he lived. I was full of beans. I had fire in my belly. I was a hero. I was St. George and the dragon. I was Edwin Booth bowing beyond the gaslights. I was Jesus Christ with the horsewhip in the temple. I was the stuff. And all at once under the stars I was like a man who's done himself the best from soup to nuts and a corona corona,
and feels like a virtuous million, and all at once there isn't anything but the yellow acid taste which has crawled up to the back of the mouth from the old tired stomach. 3 days later, I got the registered letter from Sadie Burke. It read, "Dear Jack, just so you won't think I'm going to welch on what I said I would do, I'm enclosing the statement I said I would make. I've got it witnessed and notarized and nailed down as tight as you can nail anything down, and you can do anything with it you want, for it's yours. I mean this, it's your baby, just like I said. As for me, I'm getting out of here. I don't mean just getting out of this cross between an old folks' home and a booby hatch, but out of this town and out of this state. I can't stand it round here, and I'm pulling out. I'll be gone a long way, and I'll be gone a long time, and maybe somewhere the climate will be better. But my cousin, Mrs. Syl Larkin, 2331 Rousseau Avenue, who's the nearest thing to a relative I got, will have some kind of address for me sometime, and if you ever want to contact me, just write me care of her. Wherever I am, I'll do what you say. I'll come if you say come. I don't want you thinking I'm going to welch. I don't care who knows anything. I'll do anything you say about that piece of business. But if you take my advice about that piece of business, you'll let it drop. This is not because I love Duffy. I hope you'll give him an earful and let him wet his pants. But my advice is to let it drop. First, you can't do anything in law. Second, if you use it politically, the best you can get will be to keep Duffy from being reelected, and you know as well as I do he'll never get nominated even. The boys will never nominate him, for they know he's a dummy, even by their standards. He was just something the boss kept around. Springing this stuff won't hurt the gang any. It'll just give them an excuse to get rid of Duffy. If you want to get the gang, you got to let them dig their own grave, like they sure will now the boss is gone. But third, it's sure going to be rough on that Stanton dame if you break this stuff. She may be so noble and high-toned, like you said, that she'll want you to do it, but you're a sap if you do. She's maybe had plenty to put up with already in her way, and you'd be a sap to crucify her just because you got some highfalutin idea you're an Eagle Scout and she's Joan of Arc. You'd be a sap to tell her, even. Unless you're so blabbermouth you've done it already, like you maybe have. I'm not going on to say she's my best friend, but she's had her troubles, like I said, and you might give her a break. Remember, I'm not welching. I'm just giving you my advice. Keep your tail over the dashboard. Sincerely yours, Sadie Burke. I read through Sadie's statement. It said everything there was to say, and each page was signed and witnessed. Then I folded it up. It was no good to me. Not because of the advice which Sadie had given me. Her letter made sense, all right. That is, the part about Duffy and the gang. But something had happened. To hell with them all, I thought. I was sick of it all.
This ends Disc 17. All the King's Men, Disc 18.
I looked down at the letter again. So Sadie had called me an Eagle Scout, but that wasn't news either. I'd called myself worse names than that the night after I'd seen Duffy and was walking down the street under the stars. But it touched the sore place and made it throb. It throbbed the worse because I knew that it wasn't a secret sore place. Sadie had known about it. She'd seen through me. She'd read me like a book. There was only one wry piece of consolation in the thought. At least I'd not had to wait for her to read me. I'd read myself to myself that night, walking down the street, full of beans and being an Eagle Scout, when the yellow acid taste had all at once crawled up to the back of my mouth. What had I read? I had read this. When I found out about Duffy's killing the boss and Adam, I'd felt clean and pure, and when I kicked Duffy around, I felt like a million because I thought it let me out. Duffy was the villain, and I was the avenging hero. I'd kicked Duffy around, and my head was big as a balloon with grandeur. Then all at once something happened, and the yellow taste was in the back of my mouth. This happened. I suddenly asked myself why Duffy had been so sure I would work for him. And suddenly I saw the eyes of the little squirt-faced newspaper man at the cemetery gate on me, and all the eyes that had looked at me that way. And suddenly I knew that I had tried to make Duffy into a scapegoat for me, and to set myself off from Duffy,
and my million-dollar meal of heroism backfired that yellow taste into my gullet, and I felt caught and tangled and mired and stuck like an ox in a bog and a cat in flypaper. It wasn't simply that I again saw myself as party to that conspiracy with Ann Stanton, which had committed Willie Stark and Adam Stanton to each other and to their death. It was more than that. It was as though I were caught in a more monstrous conspiracy whose meaning I couldn't fathom. It was as though the scene through which I had just lived had been a monstrous and comic miming for ends I couldn't conceive and for an audience I couldn't see but which I knew was leering from the shadow. It was as though in the midst of the scene Tiny Duffy had slowly and like a brother winked at me with his oyster eye, and I had known he knew the nightmare truth, which was that we were twins bound together more intimately and disastrously than the poor freaks of the Midway who are bound by the common stitch of flesh and gristle and the seepage of blood. We were bound together forever, and I could never hate him without hating myself or love myself without loving him. We were bound together under the unwinking eye of eternity and by the holy grace of the great Twitch whom we must all adore. And I heaved and writhed like the ox or the cat, and the acid burned my gullet, and that was all there was to it, and I hated everything and everybody, and myself and Tiny Duffy and Willie Stark and Adam Stanton. To hell with them all, I said impartially under the stars. They all looked alike to me then, and I looked like them. That was the way it was for quite a while. I didn't go back to the landing. I didn't want to see Ann Stanton. I didn't even open a letter she wrote me. It lay on my bureau where I saw it every morning. I didn't want to see anybody I knew. I hung around town and sat in my room, or sat in bars which I had never frequented, and sat in movies in the front row, where I could admire the enormous and distorted shadows which gesticulated and struck or clutched or clung and uttered asseverations which reminded you of everything which you had ever remembered. And I sat for hours in the newspaper room of the public library, the place which, like railway stations and missions and public latrines, is where the catarrhal old men and bums go, and where they sit to thumb the papers which tell about the world in which they live for a certain number of years, or to sit and wheeze and stare while the gray rain slides down the big window panes above them. It was in the newspaper room of the library that I saw Sugar Boy. It was such an improbable place to encounter him that at first I scarcely accepted the evidence of my eyes. But there he was. The rather largish head hung forward as though its weight were too much for the little stem of a neck, and I could see how thin and pink, like a baby's, the skin was over the skull in the areas where the hair had prematurely gone. His short arms and sleeves of wrinkled blue serge lay symmetrically out before him on the table, like a brace of stuffed sacks of country sausage laid on a butcher's counter. The pale, chubby hands curled innocently on the varnished yellow oak of the table. He was looking at a picture magazine. Then one of the hands, the right hand, with the quick, flickering motion which I remembered, dropped below the level of the table, to the side pocket of his coat, I presumed, and returned with a cube of sugar which he popped into his mouth. The flickering motion of the hand reminded me, and I wondered if he was still carrying a gun. I looked at the left side toward the shoulder, but I couldn't tell. Sugar Boy's blue serge coat was always a size too big for him. It was Sugar Boy, all right, and I didn't want to see him. If he should raise his head, he would look right at me. Now, while he was sunk in the picture magazine, I tried for the door. I edged over to one side easy and was almost past his natural area of vision when he lifted his head and our eyes met. He rose from the chair and came toward me. I gave an ambiguous nod which might have served merely for recognition, a rather chilly and discouraging recognition, or for a signal to follow me out to the hall where we could talk. He took the latter interpretation and followed me. I didn't wait just outside the door, but moved some distance across the hall to the steps. Those newspaper rooms in public libraries are always in a half-basement next to the men's latrine, which led up to the main lobby. Maybe he'd read something into that extra distance. But he didn't. He came padding over to me, with his blue serge trousers bagging down low off his can and the tops crumpling over his black, soft leather box-toed shoes.
Ho-ho-ho-ho-ho,
he began, and the face began its pained, apologetic contortions, and the spit flew. I'm making out, I said. How are you making out?
All right.
We stood there in the dingy, dimly lit basement hall of the public library, with the cigarette butts on the cement floor around us, and the door of the men's latrine behind us, and the air smelling of dry paper and dust and disinfectant. It was 11:30 in the morning, and outside the gray sky dripped steadily like a sogged old awning. We looked at each other. Each one knew the other was there out of the rain because he had no other place to go. He shuffled his feet on the floor, looked down at the floor, then back up at me.
I could have had a job, he declared earnestly.
Sure, I said without much interest.
I just didn't want one. Not yet, he said. I didn't feel like no job yet.
Sure, I repeated.
I got me some money saved up, he said apologetically.
Sure. He looked searchingly at me.
You got a job? He asked.
I shook my head, but was about to say in my defense what he had just said, that I could have had one if I'd wanted it. I could have been sitting up in a nice office next door to Tiny Duffy's office with my feet on a mahogany desk, if I had wanted. And as that crossed my mind, with the momentary flicker of weary self-irony, I suddenly saw, like a blaze of lightning and a clap of thunder, what the Lord had put before me. Duffy, I thought. Duffy. And there was Sugar Boy standing before me. Listen, I said, and leaned toward him in the empty hall. Listen, do you know who killed the boss? The biggish head rolled a little to one side on the little stem of a neck as he looked up at me and the face began its painful twitching.
Yeah, he said. Yeah, the son of a bitch, and I shot him.
Yeah, I said, you shot Stanton. And I thought, with an instantaneous stab, of Adam Stanton, alive a long time back and now dead, and I hated the malformed, sad little creature before me. Yeah, you shot him. The head rolled slightly and tiredly on the neck, and he repeated,
I shot him.
But suppose you don't know, I said, leaning, suppose there was somebody behind Stanton, somebody who framed him to do it. I let that sink in and watched his face twitch while no sound came. Suppose, I continued, suppose I could tell you who, suppose I could prove it, what would you do? Suddenly his face wasn't twitching. It was smooth as a baby's and peaceful, but peaceful in the way that intensity can sometimes momentarily make a face look peaceful and pure. What would you do? I demanded. I'd kill the son of a bitch, he said. And he had not stuttered at all. They'd hang you, I said.
I'd kill him. They couldn't hang me before I killed him.
Remember, I whispered, leaning closer, they'd hang you. He stared up at me, prying into my face.
Who is it?
They'd hang you. Are you sure you'd kill him?
Who?
He began. Then he clutched my coat.
You know, he said. You know something you ain't telling me.
I could tell him. I could say to him, meet me here at 3 o'clock. I want to show you something. I could bring the stuff from Sadie, the stuff that lay up in my room in a desk, and he would take one look, one look. It would be like touching a trigger. His hands were clutching and clawing at my coat.
Tell me,
he was saying. one look. It was perfect. I could meet him here in the afternoon. We could step into the latrine, and he could take one look, and I would go home.